Access number 30651, Mr. Bill Ralston, Reel 9. Now, what about the latrines? We're talking about your time in from July 52 with the 15th locating battery. I may have said 51 before, but that's a slip up by me. It's 52. What do you remember of the sort of latrines you had and conditions in them?
I have a very, very deep house, probably. Some of them I would have thought were 8 foot deep, not very big, and they would dig them out with a bucket, and dig the saw out, put it in a bucket, and a guy had a rope and was pulling it up, and then we had the sit on part of a latrine stuck over the hole, and we've got a canvas is the best way. It wasn't a purpose built thing, it was something which was just knocked up to give people sitting on there a bit of privacy sort of thing. And then when I got a bit smelly, it used to be fill it in, and you had another one always dug as a reserve light, and you had to, winter time, they had to be dug several for the winter, because digging was quite hopeless with the frozen ground. It was like trying to break through concrete sort of thing, and you didn't have no pneumatic drills or nothing to dig them. It was just a spade or a trenching tool, like, you know, what a personal trenching tool. Some guys used to prefer to have one which would last a long while. I didn't worry about the smell, because the army being the army, they wanted 5 or 6 foot of soil on it when it was finished with. So, like, the NCOs would use their authority, like, but, like, the guys didn't like that. They were just quite happy. Very, very smelly, as I say. But one position that we went into, we took over from the Van Doos. That was Princess Patricia's Canadian Light Infantry, all French, and there was a vile smell there, and they found that these guys were going to the toilet in these food cans, throwing them out the door and out the bunker, and the place absolutely stunk. And they, when they saw what was happening, like, it was an infantry battalion. We moved in with them, British Infantry Battalion, and I forget which one it was. They brought the Canadians in the next morning, early morning, because we had to go around a camouflage road to get to it. It was quite a forward position, I forget the name of the hill, the number. And they made them clear it all up, like, you know, it was become a bit more pleasant, but you would never in a million years get that sort of condition with British forces, right, you know. I suppose the thing was that these French Canadians, a lot of them were used to living up in the mountains and the forests, right, you know, near Quebec area, a lot of them came from, I believe. But that was about it, I would think, like, with latrines.
What about the weather? What was the weather like when you got out there? You know, first, because it's not winter, is it?
It's coming into to spring. Like, the summer weather was baking hot. I really mean baking hot. Like, you know, sometimes it was a bit of relief to get inside some of the bunkers, because they had so much soil, sandbags, rocks, logs on that on the roof. They weren't air conditioned, far from it, but they were quite a drop in temperature, like, when you got in there out of the sun. I started to get the onset of winter, I suppose you'd call it autumn, and that was quite cold. But then we got pulled out, and I got sent to the about eight of us. We got sent to on one of the bridges of going over the Imjin, and we were still attached to the 61st then, and they were teaching us to train us to gun drill on a Bofa gun. You know, this thing, it fires, I think, 40mm shells, I suppose about 2 inches, and they had, were in a five.
This is before you joined the locating battery?
No, this was, no, that was, sorry, I've got this a bit wrong. When I joined the locating battery, and I was there for quite some time, we had quite a stretch. No, I'm giving it to you really wrong here now.
Don't worry,
I'd gone to the locating battery some time or the other, and there for quite a long while, I would think some months, and we were permanently stationed in the line, and we really sort of weren't getting much rest or nothing. It was always up, always working, like, you know, it was all.
Were you doing much driving, because you were a driver operator?
No,
you were just
no.
In the line.
Yeah. And then when we got sent to back, and we were on the Imjin, this was a cushy post, really cushy, like there was not too much going on.
So you were with the locating battery still?
No, I'd come away from the locating battery.
So who were you posted to then?
61st. And we had both a gun there, and that was in a pit. And if, God forbid, if anybody had come and we had to fire it, we wouldn't have known how to fire it. And they taught us, we were drill all the time on this gun. We never fired it at all anyhow. When we did fire it, we were absolutely amazed. Like, there was two of these rounds were going off in a second. Bang, 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 bang. It was going, and they just fed them in five in a clip. And it was sort of as quickly as you could snap your fingers, right? You know, you.
And was it for use as an anti-aircraft gun?
We were being taught to just to use it. Being as it was near the bridges, a bridge, we used to have lookouts for enemy aircraft. I don't think any of us knew what a MiG looked like at that stage. And
You were now just with backwards 61st.
Yeah.
But you don't know which battery you're with.
No.
Then 15th locating is part of 61st.
Part of 61st.
But you don't know what you were
not
in now.
Not what yeah. We were with now. And it was very, it was a cushy posting. It was friendly. There was no problems here. They taught us a gun, and then we had one little spill of fire in it, and we got the hang of it. And then we went back into the line. I forget which
with
hill.
The Bofas or just
with the Bofa, yeah, we drove it. It was mounted on the back of a lorry. It was like a big machine gun mounted on the back of a Morris lorry. No cab or nothing on it. It was just open. You had the driver and the co-driver had a small windscreen, I would say 18 inches long, a foot high, and that was on two clips, one each to keep the dust out of your face and that. And we went, they told us what we were going to do. We were going to go up, we were going to stay just behind the brow of the hill, pull it up on the night time, and do harassing fire on the Chinese crawl trenches. We had we got bearings on it before it got dark, and then all night long we would just, they'd just give us bearing one, bearing two or whatever, and we'd fire three or four rounds just to make people keep their away.
So you couldn't see what you were aiming at? You were aiming over the top of a hill?
No, we'd be then pulled up on the, to the crest of the hill, and we just fired at random sort of thing on different targets. There's no set pattern, and then we'd pull it back over again in an hour or half hours later. They'd push, stick it back up on the hill, and that was okay.
Now, what was your job on the gun? You know what I mean? There's loaders.
I was still the radio operator and the driver, and my job was to help feed the ammunition up to the two guys or three guys who were actually working it. It was one for the elevation of the gun, one for the traverse of it, and then there was the guy feeding the rounds into the breech of it. That was okay. We'd done that for a couple of nights, and then they pulled us back to the bridge again. And
did you get any return fire?
No, because we were up there. Sometimes we would only be up there for a matter of minutes, really short, a short time. The only thing was, my memory now recalls that when we were there and the ground was very dry, these shells used to go off on percussion or something, like where they hit anything, then that caused them to explode. We had a percussion cap or something, they said, on the front of it. And when it was kicking up the dust, if you fired it for quite some time, it would then go off just after it left the barrel, right, matter of few feet away. And so what they done then to do that, they brought up jerry cans of diesel and used to spread it all into the ground, like, so as it would stop the dust from flying up. So that made it a lot more safer for us, We then went back to the bridge and had a while there.
And now, what were you doing at the bridge? Just nothing, that's
nothing.
Cushy.
Yeah, just absolute nothing, keeping ourselves clean, keeping the gun clean, continuously, we were training with it. Even though the guys had got quite efficient with it, one of the things which they were always very hot on, the barrel used to get red hot, and it was quite a lumpy old barrel, and they used to take the barrel off and put a new barrel on, like a cooled one, and we were doing that for quite a lot. Sometimes you'd change the barrel five or six times a day, so they got very efficient with it. But that was easy because we were doing it with the barrel cold, and when you got it hot, it was different kettle of fish, I can remember. And we went back into the line one afternoon, well, one evening, and then the next day they pointed out a little village in the valley. And they said, we want you to go into the village. You're going to go downhill, go into the village and shoot it up, because there's a lot of trouble from there. So we went down. Everybody was quite happy when the agreement was with the sergeant who was with us, Sergeant Newell. He said, when you're going down, he said, I want you to start firing as you're driving down, so it was over myself and the co-driver, just over our head sort of fashion. And okay, and it was I was told that as soon as you get down, swing round so as you're ready to come out. We don't want to have to, if we get any opposition, we don't want to be turning round to come up the hill. And everything went as sweet as a nut. We were so pleased when we got back. There was no retaliation to us, nothing whatsoever. And it was getting dusk. So, I think there was everybody was more or less joyful, like, you know, when it all finished. So we thought we were going back to the bridge. No, you're going to stay another day. We've got our rations and our food and everything. I've got a feeling it was the Durham Light Infantry we were with, but I couldn't swear to this. And the next day they said, we want you to go back again. And it was daylight, really daylight. And we all had a moan, and Pop Newell, our sergeant, we called him Pop. He was about 30 years of age. And he said, you've got to do it, and we complain afterwards. He said, otherwise, he said, this is mutiny, like, you know. He said, and I've got to go, he said, along with it. He said, but we'll make a strong representation to the troop commander, guy who was running the show. So, okay, anyhow, we went down and we could see puffs coming up in front of us and bangs and goodness knows what else. And the next thing I know, one had caught us right under the front, and the lorry went on its side, and the boy sitting beside me, he had one leg out of the side, like, you know, more or less on the side of the vehicle, and as the vehicle went over it, took his leg off. Well, little bit of it was hanging, I believe. And I finished up, I think I was the last one out, and I know I went out the top because there was no cab. I caught my stomach on the steering wheel, done a somersault, and I know I hit my back on the more or less like the radiator area of the lorry, and I didn't know no more. I just laid there. And
now, this was a shell, was it?
Yes, yeah.
And what had happened to the boat? Because it's just on the back, it's now tipped over.
Oh, it's just a wreck. And there was an infantry patrol came out and got us, or a group of infantrymen, like, and then they flew in an helicopter and they put this lad who lost his leg on the helicopter. The helicopter landed and it put the... So I learned afterwards that they put the helicopter between the Chinese and the patient, right? You know, the other guy, the wounded guy. And they strapped him on, and then the pilot took off, turned round, and then stuck me on the other side. So this other poor guy was there for all the sound to have a pop at him, but I don't think they did. I don't really know. I can remember.
Now, whenabouts is this? Do you have a date for this, or a rough date, or was it summer?
No, it was, I would think it was possibly late September, early October. I can remember that the helicopter landed in an American advanced dressing station, ADS, I think they called them. And a guy came out and he asked me what was wrong with me, and I couldn't speak. So they knew what was wrong with me.
And what was it? Concussion?
No, when I went out, I later learned that I had a fractured pelvis and a fractured spine. Lower, on my medical notes was two little lines like this with... another two lines going this way, and that's supposed to be a medical symbol, they told me, for fracture. And then it was LR, and that stood for lumbar region. And
now, how were you? What state were you in?
Completely paralysed. Couldn't speak, nothing. And when the Americans got hold of me, they put me in a plaster cast from the neck down to, I suppose, about 6 to 9 inches of my thigh. Like, the whole of my body was, and arms were completely encased in it. I spent quite some time in this hospital, and then they flew me out.
Were you conscious yet, or do you not know anything about this?
I was conscious, but nobody told me anything. I wasn't told what was wrong with me. I just laid there, and I couldn't talk.
And you were in this plaster cast for a lot of you.
Yeah. I suppose 4 or 5 days, I would have thought a week, something like that. And anyhow, they eventually moved me out. I don't know how I got to the airplane, but I was flown out in a Dakota to Tokyo. I can remember at Tokyo, we went into a...
Can you remember the flight, or is it a blur?
No, it's a blur. I was doped up most of the time, like with the Yanks. There were everlasting sticking needles into me. I don't know whether what I was doing or anything, right? But I know they were, the whole of that period of time was a blur sort of thing. And I can remember when we got to Tokyo, they put us in a train. And the train was full of Commonwealth forces. And this train was heaven, because it was air conditioned, it was silent running, so we wouldn't even know in this country, sort of thing. That got to Curie, and then it was back to reality. There was a 1500 weight lorry with like a frame on the back, and it took 4 stretchers, 2 on the bottom, 1 each side, the frame, 1 on the top. No cover on the lorry, and they put us on this, took the stretcher up, and drove us through Curie to the British Commonwealth Hospital. And the Yanks were giving me food in like a teapot, like drink and things like that. And I got to British Hospital, and they just looked at me, didn't even do much, took me to a ward. I still couldn't talk or nothing, couldn't move. And I looked at the bed, and they put me on a trolley, like, and they wheeled me around there. And the hospital was individual buildings which were linked up with covered walkways. And I looked at the bed, right, you know, I could see the bed out the corner of my eye, and I thought, oh, that's going to be lovely. And they tucked all the mattresses off and put great big lumps of plywood on there and plonked me on there. And I suppose I was there a couple of days. There was Queen Alexandra's nurse, like a woman. She spent a lot of time with me, and then I had a visitor from the Padre, and I thought, oh dear me, what's he here for, like, you know. And then I woke up one morning, and my arm had moved, and I knew my arm had moved in the night, and I started crying. And a couple of the guys in the ward, they called for the nurse, right, said, he's crying, this bloke, like, so I hadn't been talking. And then I realised I could talk. But what I then found, that I had 2 weights on my feet and a thing under my arms, and they were putting weights on, and they were stretching me. These weights went over the end of the bed, and the others went over the end of the bed, and they were stretching me. And then when I'd moved my arm, they decided that they're going to take the plaster off, and I could talk. This was wonderful, right? And when they said to me, I can remember her saying, why are you crying? I said, well, I can move. I found out I can move now. Like, I thought I was going to be like this forever. And it was a big inquiry why I hadn't been told, like, but British Army, like, had a, you're just a private, and no one's going to worry in them days. Anyhow,
So did they know you'd regain your movement, or did they?
When I was crying like that, she said, "What are you crying for?" And I said, "Well, I can move. I've moved. That's all I was concerned with."
And you were worried you might have paralysis forever.
Yeah, forever. Yeah. My mind was going okay, but my body wasn't moving. Anyhow, they said to me, "We're going to take the plaster off." And I suppose by this time it'd been on 10 days or something like that. And I said, "Well, how are you going to get it off?" And two medical orderlies, like male orderlies, came in and they said, "We're going to cut it off." And they had, the only way I could describe it was like a Black and Decker. And I said, "You're not doing that with me." And he said, "Well, you ain't going to move, mate." He said, "Don't matter what we want to do with you, you can't do nothing until we get this off of you." Anyhow, they ran this cutter machine up, right, you know, and then they got scissors and they pulled it off. And it stank to high heaven. And they gave me a good wash down and I was okay. And then the old padre came around and I said, "God, some of these guys in here are in a terrible state." I said, "Like, you know, and I haven't got a mark on me." And this padre, he made me feel as sick as a parrot. He said, "You're the worst one in here." And I was literally terrified. But the camaraderie in that ward was first class. Like, the guys were really good. They were sharing everything. They would come and sit. Anyone who was bedridden, like I was at that stage, they would come and sit on your bed, and you'd have jokes and that, and talking about all their love life and one thing and other, and it was good. And then the guys who used to go out used to buy little bottles of whiskey, about, I don't know, the flat ones, right, you know, and put it in their pocket. Come in, I think it was only about 4 shillings, something like that.
The third or quarter bottle.
Yeah. And they used to go in, and it used to be everybody going to the toilet, right, and have a swig. It was like medicine. It's whiskey. I don't know why we were drinking it. I think it was only because we were told we couldn't have it. Typical, like, you know, British Army, you can't have it, and so then you want it. And it was okay. Was in there for quite some time.
Had someone explained to you yet what had happened to you?
Yes.
What had actually happened?
I mean, he said that when I'd come out the lorry, like, me pelvis got fractured by catching it on the steering wheel. He reckons I'd done a somersault in midair and landed on the bonnet, on the front of the bonnet. In the doctor, it was a Major Houston, he was Australian, and he said that if I'd probably been another stone heavier, it would have been irreparable, like, you know, it would have snapped my spinal cord. If I'd have gone another 2 foot in the air, the distance to travel down, that would have snapped my spinal cord. He said, it's Harry explained it to me. He said, he drew, like, got his fingers like this. He said, and it went like that. He said, now by pulling it from top and bottom, it would come back. And he said, you were lucky, like, not to have snapped your spinal cord doing it. I went from there, I went to...
Now, how much did you improve while you were there?
Quite a lot. I could get around, I could walk. I was allowed out from 2 o'clock till 6 o'clock in the afternoon. The Commonwealth Hospital was on a bit of a hill. I had quite a few steps to go around. A very impressive place. This would have been just after Christmas I came out.
So you were there till December?
Yeah, just after Christmas. Because I know can remember being in there Christmas Day.